Hello there. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. And we open today with country music's unlikely boom. When the coronavirus hit the U.S., Gabby Barrett's breakout this year was thrown into peril. The 20-year-old country singer-songwriter had just found her footing in Nashville with the steady rise of her fiery breakthrough single entitled, I Hope. She planned to build on the momentum with a debut album and then a global tour with country idol Brad Paisley. Instead, the tour was canceled, forcing Barrett into the longest break of her life. She says, it was strange not being on the road. It's pretty much all I know, unquote. Well, it looked as if country music itself were facing hard times. The scaling back of the physical spaces where the genre thrives, in concert halls and in bars, radio and concert tours, emphasized its vulnerability in the virtual realm. Having prided itself on resisting the technological changes that have transformed the music industry, country risked falling even further behind hip-hop and pop, which dominate apps like TikTok and streaming services that now represent 80% of the total music industry revenue. Then something unexpected happened. The song I Hope exploded in popularity, topping the three major Billboard country charts and becoming the first debut single by a woman to top Billboard's country streaming songs chart. Meanwhile, the genre broke out at large, and it hit a record number of streams for 3 weeks in a row, while pop, hip-hop, and Latin all sank below their baseline average. Country's popularity has only grown during the pandemic, while the overall industry has risen only about 2.5% on streaming services compared with its baseline pre-COVID numbers. Country music has soared to almost 16%. Country music concerts have been among the first to spring back across the United States at varying levels of social distancing, while at the same time rising stars like Luke Combs, Morgan Wallen, and Barrett racking up huge streaming numbers and crossing over into mainstream success. Experts suggest the reasons for this are both emotional and technological, as some listeners seek comfort in the soothing, nostalgic qualities of this genre, while others who previously disdained streaming platforms finally caved in and subscribed. But while these factors might be temporary, they are also building a new foundation for country's digital era resurgence. Its fans' increasing willingness to engage in digital platforms, combined with its artists' explorations beyond Nashville conventions of songwriting and sound, could move the genre back toward the center of mainstream consciousness. It's not a new phenomenon for country music to rise and fall with the seasons. A representative for Nielsen Ratings says that they expect country music listenership to increase during the warmer half of the year, when the genre serves as the soundtrack for cookouts, road trips, and at tailgate parties. Summer also is when touring giants like Garth Brooks and Jason Aldean hit the road, and ranking in millions of revenue. And now it's game on. The first console reached homes 11 years before Nintendo, launching an odyssey for gamers. As long as there have been computers, people have been playing games on them. In the late 1940s, Dumont Laboratories' cathode ray tube amusement device was the way the patent was described, allowed a user to aim an electromagnetic beam at plastic targets that had been placed on a cathode ray tube. But this game and its successors, like Tennis for Two in 1958 and Space War in 1962, were never marketed to the masses. They were largely curiosities for engineers and the early programmers. The first home video game gadget was imagined in 1966 by a man named Ralph Baer, who held a degree in television engineering from American Television Institute of Technology in Chicago, and was designing electronic training systems for Sanders Associates, which was a military contractor. Conceiving the first profitable non-broadcast use for the TVs that were now in almost every American home, he noticed that the military training devices he was developing seemed well suited for entertainment. Baer convinced Sanders to give him $2,500 and lend him two engineers in 1967, and they tried to develop a game for TV. The result was the Brown Box, which Magnavox licensed from Sanders in 1971 and released the following year, renaming it the Odyssey. It came with a master control unit, two blockish controllers, and 12 electronic games, including Cat and Mouse and Haunted House. Magnavox released the Odyssey in 1972. The same year, Atari's Pong appeared. And while Magnavox boasted that the machine would offer a total play and learning experience for all ages, it sold a disappointing 350,000 units worldwide. The Odyssey proved a commercial failure, but its use of interchangeable cartridges paved the way for systems like the Atari 2600, which came out in 1977, and the Nintendo Entertainment System in 1983, which drew players out of the arcades and back to the comforts of their homes. Where, of course, they remain today, thanks to the internet and multiplayer systems like the Xbox, PlayStation, and Nintendo's Switch. In 2006, Baer donated his prototypes and early schematics to the Smithsonian. He died in 2014 at the age of 92 in Manchester, New Hampshire. But today, 214 million people in this country play games on consoles, computers, and phones. Baer couldn't have foreseen that his Brown Box would launch a $151 billion global industry and convert our world into one sprawling, chatty arcade. Thank you. Are you ready for some stories that gilded the American image? Well, folklore has always been a vital ingredient in American history. And in the recent book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood, historian Colin Woodward explores how America's image was crafted and how that national mythology has changed over the decades. And I should point out, before I go into a brief review of the book, that all nations have a mythology. Ours, our country is no different, and that we have a number of, shall I say, folklore beliefs that haven't quite come to fruition. Well, let's go on with the review then. The move to ennoble the American story began early. In 1800, a Maryland parson named Mason Weems published The Life of Washington, a sanctification of George Washington that included the famous but apocryphal line, "I cannot tell a lie." Well, if apocryphy can work for a man, why not a country? And in 1832, George Bancroft began writing his History of the United States of America with the goal to help guide its people to their destiny. And by destiny, Woodward means the cultural movement known as Manifest Destiny, the rhetoric of which inspired the most spirited advocates of annexation and war for our country. Tragically, racism has permeated the national narrative. In 1893, Woodrow Wilson, the future president, published Division and Reunion, 1829 to 1889, in which he wrote that enslaved people in the American South were comfortably quartered and were kept from overwork by their own laziness and by the slack discipline to which they were subjected. And then he became president later on. Wilson also praised T.W. Griffith's 1915 film, The Birth of a Nation, which drew large audiences. And in Boston, the film caused what Woodward calls the first black civil rights demonstration in U.S. history. Instances such as these demonstrate the high stakes for a nation that has prided itself on equality and justice. Yes, the fight goes on. It's time now for some environmental news around the world. First, we go to the southern hemisphere, to the archipelago of Tristan da Cunha. You'll need your atlases to find that place because it's a dot on the map. But there, the British government's Blue Belt program is establishing the world's fourth largest marine sanctuary around the archipelago of Tristan da Cunha. The project will cover 265,000 square miles in the South Atlantic Ocean, protect 90% of the waters surrounding this remote island chain from extractive activities such as fishing and mining. Conservationists say the unique ecosystem is a critical nursery for blue sharks, but faces several threats, including illegal fishing, and invasive species. A recent study found that extending protected ocean zones by even 5% could lead to at least a 20% improvement in future fishing catches. And from Tristan da Cunha, we go over to Africa, to the country of Kenya, where community groups are using sustainable activities to combat illegal logging and development of in the forests near Nairobi, the capital. Conservationists say that the once lush Thogoto Forest, considered valuable for its proximity to the capital, had become sparse as the result of unlawful encroachment driven by the rising demand for charcoal and for timber. Now, several grassroots initiatives are coalescing to help restore and defend these lands. Local farmers are planting bamboo to help fill gaps in the forest, while young people who might otherwise turn to logging for income are being recruited as tour guides. And now we jump to Asia. We're going to China. China will now require restaurants, delivery companies, and e-commerce platforms to report their single-use plastic consumption and submit recycling plans as part of a nationwide effort to tackle plastic pollution. China produces the most single-use plastic of any country, with much of that waste ending up in landfills or in rivers. Critics say the bans will help address the most visible levels of plastic pollution, but that expanding recycling programs is also necessary as well. And now, for something entirely different, we're going to give you a little music break, and we'll be right back. Now, Ask the Smithsonian. We've done this before. The Smithsonian has the experts, and people have questions which they send in. Here are some for this week. First question: why do the planets all orbit the sun in the same plane? The explanation is because of the way the sun formed. About 4.5 billion years ago, a massive cloud of dust started contracting as gravity pulled its parts toward the center. This dust cloud rotated slowly at first, but then sped up as it contracted, in much the same way that a figure skater spins more quickly when she pulls her arms closer to her body. This law of physics, which makes things spin faster as they contract, is called angular momentum. The faster rotation flattened the cloud into a pancake, with the sun at the center and planets forming within that plane. Planetary systems around other stars tend to form in a similar way. And then another question. Since smoking is banned on almost all airlines, why are there still no smoking signs above each row and ashtrays in airplane bathrooms? It's more of a hassle than it's worth to remove the signs from decades-old airplanes. the process of getting Federal Aviation Administration approval to alter a commercial aircraft cabin is cumbersome. And though smoking has become prohibited on all major airlines for the past 20 years, the agency still requires an ashtray in the lavatory as a safety measure because some passengers persist in trying to light up in secret. In one notorious instance, a 2013 flight from Nova Scotia to the Dominican Republic had to make an emergency stop in Bermuda when an entire family was caught smoking in the lavatory. Now, how did they all get into that small space? They must have been very small people. Well, how long does it take for a flower to replenish its nectar supply? I know you've been thinking about this for a long time. Well, here's the answer. It all depends on the creature the flower evolved to attract. Nectar is a sugar-based substance that lures pollinators so that their bodies transfer bits of fertilizing pollen from flower to flower. Plants adjust their nectar production to match the needs of their pollinators. Small blue borage flowers, which attract bees and butterflies, can replenish their nectar in 2 minutes. But agave plants, which attract needle-nosed bats, produce nectar only at night. A recent study found that the evening primrose is able to detect the specific sound frequencies of its bee pollinators. And when it does, it produces fresh nectar in 3 minutes to attract them. And now we're headed for home after this brief interlude. We're going out today with a little bit of wit and a little bit of wisdom from famous people. Let's start with Bob Dylan. Bob said, "A man is a success if he gets up in the morning and gets to bed at night, and in between does what he wants to do." The Godfather character in the movie, Michael Corleone, said, "Never hate your enemies. It affects their judgment." And the artist Jenny Holzer has an apt quote here. I think it says, "Savor kindness because cruelty is always possible later." And then author Jerome K. Jerome has said, "I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours and hours." I think that refers to some of the students I used to have, but I'm not sure. And then Marianne Moore, the poet, she has said, "That which is impossible to force, it is impossible to hinder." And the psychologist Eric Fromm is quoted as saying, "To die is poignantly bitter, but the idea of having to die without having lived is unbearable." And finally, we end up with the humorous Josh Billings saying, Adam invented love at first sight. This is one of the greatest labor-saving machines the world ever saw. And that's all the wit and wisdom for this week. Hope you enjoyed that. And now, I think it's time that we prepare to leave you for this week. We'll certainly hope that you tune in to 101.5 next week. I want you to listen to a little of this, a little of that. You never know exactly what you're going to hear or the diversity of topics. So until next time, this is Dan Dillman asking you to be safe. Take care. Wear your mask. Be sure that you social distance. It helps us all. Have a good day, my friends. And tune in to a little of this, a little of that. I'll be waiting for you. I hope you have a good day. Goodbye.